This 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. A monitoring group says the battle for the Syrian city of Aleppo is in its final stage. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says rebel forces are withdrawing from their last holdouts in face of an advancing government troop force. Earlier, the Syrian government recaptured a southern district and carried out airstrikes against the last remaining areas controlled by opposition forces. About 200 kilometers to the southwest, the Islamic State group was reported in full control of Palmyra after 4 days of fighting outside the city. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter visited Israel Monday to help celebrate the arrival of the country's first two F-35 fighter jets built by the U.S. firm Lockheed Martin.
This evening, we're celebrating the remarkable progress of the U.S.-Israel defense relationship and also of an Air Force that began by flying leftover World War II planes and is now flying the most advanced aircraft in history.
Israel is among several countries that have ordered the jets and has plans to buy 50 of them. Portugal's Antonio Guterres was sworn in Monday as the 9th UN Secretary General.
Thank you very much for all your kind words. I am deeply honored by the trust and confidence member states have placed in me and determined to be guided by the purposes and principles of the Charter.
Guterres told member states that the United Nations needs to be nimble, efficient, and effective. He said it must focus more on delivery and less on process, more on people, he says, and less on bureaucracy. This is VOA News. President-elect Donald Trump says he will announce his choice for Secretary of State Tuesday. Observers are expecting him to appoint ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson to the job. A federal judge has rejected an attempt to suspend a law in Colorado that forces the state's electors to vote for the winner of the November election. The ruling is a setback to plans by several electors to try to block Donald Trump from winning the Electoral College vote. A recount of votes in the state of Wisconsin has dealt another disappointment to anti-Trump forces. It turns out that Trump not only won the election there, but after a recount, he actually won by an increased margin. Donald Trump fired a new broadside Monday at the Central Intelligence Agency's reported finding that Russia interfered in the presidential election to help Trump win. Trump said if Democrat Hillary Clinton had won and Republicans had complained of Russian interference, they would have been accused of promoting a conspiracy theory. Meanwhile, the Senate Republican majority leader voiced confidence in the CIA and said Russian activities must be probed. Michael Bowman reports.
The Russians are not our friends.
Senator Mitch McConnell told reporters Russian hacking must be taken seriously.
Obviously, any foreign breach of our cybersecurity measures is disturbing.
McConnell did not call for a special congressional committee to lead the probe, saying existing committees can do the job. He weighed in as new questions arose about the relationship President-elect Donald Trump will have with intelligence agencies.
I have the highest confidence in the intelligence community and especially the Central Intelligence Agencies.
Trump has dismissed CIA assertions of Russian hacking as the Obama administration diverting attention from Democratic electoral losses. Michael Bowman, The Capitol.
U.S. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid blames FBI Director James Comey for the Democrats' loss in the last election. Reid says Comey ignored pleas to investigate possible Russian interference. He said he believes the Democrats would have won the Senate and that Donald Trump would have lost the presidency if Comey had acted. The European Union and Cuba have signed an agreement to normalize ties that had been blocked for decades by human rights concerns under the late communist leader Fidel Castro. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez Parilla and European Union of Foreign Affairs Chief Federica Mogherini, along with representatives from the 28 EU member states, signed the agreement Monday in Brussels. Italy's center-left coalition is now headed by a new prime minister. He is Paolo Gentiloni, and his administration is quite similar to the one that just ended. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Tuesday, the 13th of December, and here are some of the stories we're covering. A week from the end of the DRC President Joseph Kabila's second term, both the U.S. and the EU have hit his senior officials with targeted sanctions.
Lambert Mende, Kabila's communications minister, told VOA that nothing authorizes the American administration to sanction a government and a country that is not subject to American law and does not have any problem with the American people.
VOA's William Close reporting from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. And some great news in the fight against malaria as the WHO reports strong progress that despite of big funding gaps.
The progress is that now 53%, just over half that target population, and it's a very large target population in some very difficult to reach places, 53% of those people report now sleeping under an insecticide treated net. That's fantastic.
Dr. Joe Lyons of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And West African leaders traveled to the Gambia today in an effort to persuade long-term President Yahya Jammeh to step down after his loss in the December 1 elections. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A week from the end of President Joseph Kabila's second term in office, both the US and the EU have hit his senior officials with targeted sanctions. William Close has the latest from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa.
On Monday, both the European Union and the US government imposed targeted sanctions on Congolese officials, ramping up the pressure on President Joseph Kabila a week from the end of his second and supposedly final term. Lambert Mende, Kabila's communications minister, told VOA that nothing authorizes the American administration to sanction a government and a country that is not subject to American law and does not have any problem with the American people. Mende said that the Congolese know that, like a sheep, the EU is inclined to follow decisions taken in Washington. After months of deliberations, the EU slapped travel bans and asset freezes on seven senior Congolese security officials. They are accused of obstructing a peaceful solution towards elections and planning, directing, or committing serious human rights violations. Six of them are accused of overseeing the violent repression of an opposition protest in Kinshasa during September, during which security forces killed more than 50 people, according to the United Nations. Since June, the Obama administration has sanctioned three of Kabila's generals, but has now designated Evariste Boshab, who is both Vice Prime Minister and Interior Minister, and Kalev Mutond, Kabila's intelligence chief. It's an escalation of hostility by the Obama administration, Mende told VOA. We do not consider it an action of the US, he said, because Obama no longer represents the US. Elections to select Kabila's successor as president were supposed to happen last month, but they were not organized. Kabila now plans to stay in power beyond the end of his second mandate until at least April 2018, when he says it will be possible to hold elections. Many of his opponents believe the president has deliberately delayed elections and that he would like to change the constitution, allowing him to seek a third term. VOA spoke to Jean-Claude Katende, the president of the African Association for the Defense of Human Rights. Katende said he is satisfied with the sanctions. He congratulated the EU for starting its program, but would have preferred for political actors as well as security officials to be targeted. Katende welcomed the decision of the US to move its focus towards political figures, those he said give the orders. On Tuesday, the main opposition coalition, known as the Rassemblement, will start direct negotiations with Kabila's political alliance. The talks are mediated by the Catholic Church and are being billed as a last-chance effort to avoid uncertainty and possible violence on December 19th. Kabila's Minister for Parliamentary Relations, Trifon Kinkie, thinks the sanctions are dangerously timed. Kinkie said the decisions taken by the US and the EU are aimed only at radicalizing the opposition, which is engaged in negotiations with the bishops. Kinkie says such decisions do little to help bring about peace. Katende, however, hopes that the US and the EU continue to apply pressure on the Kabila administration. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
And West African leaders will travel to Gambia today in an effort to persuade long-term President Yahya Jammeh to step down after his loss in the December 1 election. Jammeh initially conceded defeat to election winner Adama Barrow, but withdrew his concession late Friday, saying unacceptable errors were found by election officials. Reports from West Africa say that Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf will lead a delegation that will travel to the Gambian capital, Banjul, and ask Jammeh to accept the election result. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power said the delegation will include Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, Sierra Leone leader Ernest Bai Koroma, and outgoing Ghanaian President John Mahama. She said that it's significant that Mahama is included because he conceded defeat on Friday after losing Ghana's presidential election. Ambassador Power described the situation in Gambia as a very dangerous moment for the country. In her role as the chairperson of the West African bloc, ECOWAS, President Johnson Sirleaf said Saturday that Jammeh's reversal is unacceptable and threatens peace in Gambia and the entire West African sub-region. She called on Jammeh to do the right thing and facilitate a smooth transfer of power. She also called on President-elect Barrow and his supporters to exercise restraint. In its latest annual report, the World Health Organization says strong progress has been made in the fight against malaria, particularly in offering effective control programs to children and pregnant women in Africa. The organization, however, warns that funding has plateaued, which puts targets for tackling the disease at a risk. Henry Ridgewell reports.
The World Health Organization's 2016 report highlights significant achievements in the global fight against malaria. Mortality rates, the annual number of deaths from malaria, have been halved in the past 16 years to just over 400,000. Programs to distribute insecticide-treated mosquito nets are the cornerstone of malaria prevention efforts in Africa, says Dr. Joe Lines of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
The progress is that now 53%, just over half that target population, and it's a very large target population in some very difficult to reach places, 53% of those people report now sleeping under an insecticide-treated net. That's fantastic.
As more insecticide is used to prevent malaria, however, the mosquitoes, the vectors that transmit the disease, are becoming resistant.
Insecticide resistance is spreading very rapidly. Now that we're achieving those high levels of coverage, it's spreading more rapidly than ever and becoming really strong in some places. So there are places in Africa now that report their mosquitoes can stand 1,000 times the dose of the original population.
Diagnostic testing for malaria has also increased sharply in the last 5 years, allowing for the rapid prescription of life-saving treatment, particularly for children. Again, Dr. Lines.
What's clear now is that we need to do much more differentiated set of interventions. We need to tailor what we're doing to each place.
By far, the highest share of the global malaria burden is borne by sub-Saharan Africa, where 92% of malaria deaths occurred in 2015. Dr. Pedro Alonso Fernandez, the director of WHO's Global Malaria Programme, says progress is being hampered by a lack of funds.
The last 5 years, we have seen no increase on the level of funding, be this from international donors or domestic funding from the affected countries themselves. We are not on track to achieve our goals unless we increase the amount of resources made available to the fight against malaria.
The WHO says more needs to be done to prevent and treat malaria infection in children. Children under the age of 5 account for an estimated 70% of all malaria deaths. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A member of the political bureau of the SPLM in opposition is in Washington this week to meet with members of the diaspora as well as think tanks in the area. In her first interview since escaping the violence that erupted in Juba in July, Angelina Tenye tells VOA South Sudan reporter Ayen Bior that she is arguing policymakers in Washington to prevent a genocide from taking place in South Sudan.
Tenny was one of a handful of SPLMIO leaders who came to meet with the South Sudanese diaspora here in the Washington, D.C. area. Tunney describes the security situation in Juba as the single biggest hurdle all parties must tackle before peace can be attained. Her party has major concerns when it comes to the security arrangements in Juba, including the size of the forces and the dismissal of all Ugandan troops from the capital.
Once you address the issues of security, and especially the demilitarization of Juba, then you now have a first advanced team that would go to Juba. And if you had an advanced team that went to Juba, automatically, you know, people will begin to discuss and to move forth.
The opposition is not only demanding the withdrawal of Ugandan troops from Juba, it wants to limit the number of soldiers in Juba to 2,000 or 3,000. The government of South Sudan is demanding there be at least 5 times that amount stationed in the capital. Tenney says establishing demilitarized zones and agreeing on the size of the security force is a large source of tension between the two sides.
But this big hurdle of the security arrangements, transitional security arrangements, especially in Juba, is an issue that needs to be addressed. You know, people are very apprehensive because of what happened in Juba. It's not about the opposition per se, but you have people who are in refugee camps, in UN camps, site. And you'd want to make sure and ensure that the protection is about the civil population. And this transitional period is a period where we want to prepare for a number of things.
Just yesterday, IGAD released a statement saying both sides have violated the agreement since it was signed by both leaders in August. Tenney says she does not think President Kiir's insistence on repeatedly bringing up his reservations about the deal is helping matters in South Sudan.
Yes, this agreement was imposed. This agreement, you could not say that it was really a settlement that both parties were comfortable with. But that's how it is with peace agreements, because it's give and take. And since it has been signed, we should commit ourselves to it, committing ourselves to its implementation.
The group of SPLMIO leaders is expected to travel around the United States for another week in hopes of garnering more international support for implementation of the peace deal. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
Becoming a refugee is challenging enough, but being an orphan with the responsibility to head a family is more challenging. Reporter Mugume Davis Rakarinji talked to a young female Congolese refugee in Uganda's capital, Kampala, and files this report.
24-year-old Diane Fatumata, a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, dreamt of getting a formal employment in her native country when she completed school. But when her parents were kidnapped from her home in 2011, Fatumata says she had no choice but flee for her dear life, taking along with her her 4 siblings, including a then 7-year-old youngest brother. Spending days along the way, they eventually made it to the UNHCR offices in Uganda. Fatumata says taking care of the young siblings is a daunting task.
Taking care of the young one is very difficult. They want to put on designer and trendy clothes and also want to go for outings. Whenever I try to explain to them that I struggle to get money for food and rent, they still don't understand.
Tomata says she and her siblings are not content enough, but are glad that they are allowed to live peacefully in any part of Uganda. She says life as a refugee is challenging. She says she has a degree in education and a diploma in international relations, but still cannot find a formal job. With no hope if her parents are still alive, Fatumata says they will never go back home.
Our house was destroyed and I don't have my parents there. I would rather keep working from around here, or maybe if we are lucky and get a third country for relocation so we can get formal employment. But for now, I don't have any plans of traveling back to my country.
According to a World Bank study on forced displacement and mixed migration in the Horn of Africa, Uganda's policy enshrined in the Refugee Act 2006 is considered one of the most progressive and generous in the world. Godfrey Byaruhanga works in the office of the Prime Minister in Adjumani. He says the government is working on a program to give refugees like Fatoumata an education. He says refugees too can play a role in development of the host country.
Some of them have been doctors, have been teachers, others have been business people. So when they reach here, most of them with qualifications, they are allowed to work. By the way, our policy now, they don't need a work permit when they are here. You don't need a work permit. And when you are working, of course, or if you are engaged in any productive activity, you will also be subject to taxes like any other Ugandan.
Uganda is home to over 1 million refugees and asylum seekers, mainly from South Sudan, Rwanda, DR Congo, and Somalia. But the UN Refugee Agency has said it does not have enough resources to help fund refugee activities in the country. Reporting for Daybreak Africa, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinj, in Kampala, Uganda.
African agriculture officials have converged on Cameroon to map out ways of processing the continent's enormous food resources instead of exporting the raw products to Europe. The International Trade Fair on Agriculture and Agrobusiness is focusing on cassava crop, hoping to add value to the more than 200 million tons of the starchy tuber Africa produces each year. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
300 women, members of the Akono Cassava Farmers Association, peel, boil, steam, slice, pound, roast and ferment cassava roots and leaves. Farmer Teme Florence says the processing makes cassava usable in many ways.
Nous faisons le whisky, les biscuits, les croquettes, les chips de manioc.
She says besides consuming cassava leaves as vegetables and cassava roots as a basic food, the women transform it into starch, whiskey, beer, flour gari, toasted granules, chips, and many other products. She says they use cassava skin as animal feed. Cassava Production Cooperative President Marie-Joseph Nzanafuda says they use traditional methods to process the tuber because they lack modern equipment.
Pour l'instant, nous travaillons encore manuellement.
She says they also have been longing for tractors so they can stop manual work on their farms and increase cassava production, helping themselves and the many people who approach them to learn how to cultivate cassava to supplement their incomes. Most of Africa's cassava is exported to America, Thailand, and Brazil, countries that have high annual consumption of starch products. Japan imports nearly 1 million tons a year. DRC agriculture official Stanley Yimgain says it is time for Africa to reduce raw exports and process cassava at home to create jobs.
We find that cassava production, if it remains traditional, will not be able to benefit from the opportunities that are coming up now with processing, industrialization. So the forum is trying to bridge the gap between what the industrialists are looking for, what the small-scale producers are doing and are producing, and how can we meet halfway so that the benefits also comes to the smallholder farmers. We would like to see that agriculture is a business opportunity and not just what, you know, our parents used to do.
The Central African Republic representative at the forum, Samson Garase, says African countries lack the technical and financial means to equip rural communities to process cassava.
En Centrafrique, le maïs est l'alimentation de base.
He says 90% of the population of the Central African Republic consume cassava, but average production in the CAR has stagnated since it is difficult to develop the sector and process and export the tuber in the absence of funds. He says the CAR is expecting funding agencies to help them grow from artisanal to industrial production. The participants are learning from Nigeria. From 33 million tons in 1999, Nigeria now produces 45 million, about 20% of the world's production. Agriculture engineer Vincent Noble, who coordinates the program to develop French agro-industries, says Nigeria and West African countries have greatly increased labor efficiency, incomes, and standards of living through cassava farming.
Le gros avantage de ce forage, c'est la possibilité.
He says the most important thing about the cassava forum is that it provides an opportunity for Africa to learn from the example of West Africa, which has succeeded in industrial transformation to add value to the product and create jobs. Cassava is one of the most important staple food crops in tropical Africa, playing a major role in efforts to alleviate food shortages because of its availability year-round and tolerance to extreme conditions. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
In Syria, the fall of rebel-controlled districts of eastern Aleppo to the forces of President Bashar al-Assad is likely to prove a decisive victory in the five-year civil war. The fall has major symbolic significance and leaves the regime and its fallen backers, Russia and Iran, free to focus their military might on remaining rebel strongholds in the rest of western Syria. While rebel commanders and opposition politicians insist the loss of Aleppo won't mark the end of the uprising, few doubt that battlefield fortunes have swung heavily against them, and with the regime possibly hours away from seizing what is left of insurgent-controlled eastern Aleppo, the dynamic of resistance will have to change to guerrilla warfare to keep the revolution alive. Portugal's Antonio Guterres was sworn in on Monday as the 9th UN Secretary General. The 67-year-old former Prime Minister and UN refugee chief beat out more than a dozen other candidates during a 10-month-long public process to lead the organization. With the world facing its largest refugee and migrant crisis since World War II, numerous armed conflicts in the Middle East and Africa, the threat of terrorism and effects of climate change, Guterres will have a full plate when he takes up his duties on January 1st from outgoing UN chief Ban Ki-moon. Guterres said that he would make conflict prevention his top priority, saying, quote, "Where prevention fails, we must do more to resolve conflicts." He said, adding that he would use his good offices to personally engage in conflict resolution where it brings added value. During a post-ceremony news conference, Guterres was asked what he would do about the situation in Syria. He said he hopes to be an honest broker, creating the conditions for confidence to be established to find a solution. And that's it for this Tuesday, the 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all in Africa a good Tuesday.
Tuesday on Health Chat, Global Health and Human Rights. We will explore the right to health and health-related human rights. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.